between 6 and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, live from Studio B, it's the Jonathan Wright Show. Find it right here at revolution.radio.
The Secret Kindergarten is here for the young children of the world. The best program on the radio for kids. Dealing with the most important topics in the whole universe. Fairy tales, music and movement, numbers, plants, animals, fun, colors, insects. Take care and cast your ears out to catch a story from the world of other young things. Reach out, up, under, and over. Sing a song. Talk about feelings. Just remember the magic word. The magic word is no. Step on into the Secret Kindergarten. Saturdays, 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Right here on Revolution Radio.
Anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look!
Just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that. What? Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. All right, thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Good evening. It's April 20th, and you're listening to Celebrate Truth. I'm your host, Robbie Davidson. We've got a good podcast for you to listen to this evening. That's right. Tucker Carlson was on with Joe Rogan. This just absolutely aired, blew my mind, the conversations that these guys had. Now, if you want to listen to the whole thing in full, obviously, go to YouTube, check it out. We're going to be only playing a little bit of the actual podcast compared to everything that was said. But we're going to get into some good stuff this evening. So don't go anywhere because, guys, this is literally mainstream now. This is not corporate media. This is mainstream media. The conversations that we're getting into are things that would have got you banned even a few years ago. A lot of the stuff being said, I believe, in 2024 is they're going to be putting the hammer down as well, too. But anyways, very important. Get this message out. Share it with many people as you can, because this is an important conversation.
Right. If you go Bobby Kennedy, they'll come for you.
But the question is why? Look, and I don't know the answer, but
how is that not in the debate? How is that not in the conversation?
Well, it's not only not in the conversation, you're punished for adding it to the conversation.
Yes.
And so, like,
we are dancing around anti-vax conspiracy theories
but
right now.
Why be on the defensive? It's like, right, if you purport to represent science and you're mad about a question.
And you're ignoring data.
Yeah, but even in the absence of data.
Right.
Science is a process.
Yes.
It's not a result. It's a way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And at the core of science is asking questions, including unlikely questions.
Right.
That's what science is.
Right.
And if you don't allow that, then, you know, you may be doing something, but what you're not doing is science. We can say that conclusively.
Right.
So for people to wrap themselves in the mantle of science and attack you for asking a question, you know, they're frauds. And I don't know how they have the moral high ground in this.
I don't think they do, but I think it's the same kind of mindset that allows people to create the nuclear bomb. Because you say, listen, we're not even saying that vaccines cause autism, but let's say this. If you're looking at all the data of all the things that cause autism, and you see that the vaccine schedule ramps up considerably, and then you have autism, which seems to at least be more diagnosed than ever before. People will instantly say, we stopped polio, we stopped smallpox, vaccines have saved millions of lives, and they're probably right. We dropped that bomb to keep Germany from dropping that bomb. We need nuclear weapons so that other people don't have nuclear weapons. We do a thing that maybe has some negative effects but is overall good. And I think you can kind of apply that sort of logic and reasoning as a human being to very messy issues.
Well,
I think people
and we
do
all
that.
Do, by the way.
People do that with abortion, right?
Sure.
They do that with abortion.
They do
say
with everything.
A woman has a right to choose. Reproductive freedom. They say all these things. And then you say, okay, what if the baby is near term? What if it's 6 months old? What if it's 7 months old? And people don't want to have that conversation.
Why?
A woman has the right to choose. You're a fascist. Stay out of women's
Does
bodies.
Does a woman have a right to kill you if you annoy her or inconvenience her?
Well, this is where it gets weird. It's like, when is it a life? But it is one of those things that, to me, is a human problem. Yeah. Whereas humans have these very messy interactions with some things that don't line up with their ideology. And there's an ideology of science worship. There's an ideology of authoritarian worship. The bodies of science have bestowed the truth. If you ignore it, you're a science denier. And, you know, those are
political terms or theological terms. Mm-hmm. They're not terms rooted in science. And look, we all make trade-offs constantly. You know what? There's, you know, everything's bad. It's a shit sandwich versus a shit croissant. I'll take the shit croissant. It's smaller. You know, like that's a daily experience for everybody. So I get that, and I don't think everything is a moral absolute either. You know, we don't even know sometimes whether a decision will result in good or bad. So like, it's very complicated. I totally agree with that. What I object to is the absence of reason.
Right.
Like, you have to believe, because I think it's true, that if you're reasonable, that you can reach maybe not the perfect decision, but a better decision. And if we don't believe that, then we're just in the land of witchcraft, and let's just admit it. So the lack of reason is what freaks me out.
Well, it's ideological capture, right? Because there's certain things that if you're on the right side of these subjects, the correct side, whatever your ideology believes, you can't differ from the doctrine. There's a very clear
doctrine.
Well,
that's just religion then.
It is.
Yeah.
It is religion.
So I'm very pro-religion, but you can't have a religion that's too stupid and destructive. If your religion winds up hurting a lot of people, then I'm against your religion. Like, that's right?
Yeah, I think – but even some really good religions have aspects of them that you could say were overall detrimental to the people that were
– Sure. Well, absolutely, you could
encountered
say
that. With them.
Yeah.
I think that – that kind of thinking, I think cult thinking, whether it's Scientology or whether it's Christianity, or there's like a type of thinking or that's woke. Woke is clearly a cult. It's a mind virus. And I think that it's so trite to call it that now. It's like whatever this thing is, this leftism, this Marxist sort of ideology that's waving its flag and indoctrinating people in this country. It's very similar to all kinds of religions. It's very similar to fundamentalist religions that have always existed, in that everybody has to believe very specific things and you can't differ. You can't differ from the doctrine. And when
here's another way to think about it that I've been meditating on this a lot. Yes. Religion, politics, they're all kind of melding. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know where one ends and another begins.
Right.
So maybe a simpler and more useful way to think about it is truth or falsehood, lying or honesty.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just assess everything that way. Is someone lying?
Right.
I don't care what your justification for it is. Lying about vaccines. They've lied a lot about vaccines. And they've done it, I think, in most cases because they feel like they're serving some greater good.
Right.
Like,
well, that's the narrative, right?
Right. We can't tell people that there are vaccine injuries because they won't get vaccines, which are good for a big population. I understand the thinking. But how about this? You can't participate in lying. You can't lie.
You can't lie, and you can't.
Period, though. You can't lie about anything. Just don't lie about anything. Try to tell the truth all the time. If you can't say something that's true, just don't say it.
Right.
You're not required to say everything you think, obviously, and you shouldn't say everything you think. But you should never lie. And if you just stick with that, like, you get pretty quickly back to reason and order, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're making complete sense. And I think that this is the problem when people have information and power above other people.
Well, right. That's right. For sure.
Which is the problem of governments, which is also the problem of cult leaders.
Yeah.
You know, cult leaders, they get completely infatuated with this idea of being omnipotent and this power that has control over giant swaths of people, and you get to dictate their behavior and you get to tell them what to think. That's very intoxicating, and it's common. It's common in that it's always existed throughout human history. It's a thing that people do when they get power. They abuse the shit out of it. And if they think that you're too stupid to know the truth and that they're better than you, because they do think they're better than you because they're running things, it's a natural inclination. It's a natural thought that people have. If they're the ones – if you guys are a bunch of dopes – that are just listening to my orders, and I tell you how to live your life and what to do, I'm naturally going to think I'm better than you.
Well, that's – I mean, people have lived under those systems since there have been systems. But
always.
What makes it particularly galling and hard to live with is when you call that system a democracy.
Right.
That's too dishonest for me. I would much rather live in a monarchy where – everyone thinks the king has been assigned by God to rule over us and his whims are law. And, you know, that makes sense. I don't like it, but at least it has internal coherence.
Right.
When they stand up and pass a $60 billion funding bill for Ukraine when 70% of the population doesn't want it, when they're ignoring the actual problems in our country like the economy and the border, and they're hauling in Congress over the weekend to pass something that people don't want – while ignoring the things that people do want, and if they do the same kind of thing again and again for like 50 years and they call it a democracy, that will drive you insane.
Yeah.
Because it's just too dishonest. Why not just say, we don't give a shit what you want. We are getting something out of this Ukraine funding, whether it's like the thrill of being masters of the universe or whether it's money from the defense contractors, whatever we're getting out of it is more important to us than your opinion. This is not self-government. You don't run this country. We do. Shut up and obey. If they at least said that, you'd be like, okay, I get it. Those are the terms. But if I get another fucking lecture from Joe Scarborough about defending democracy when this is not a democracy, it's not even a close approximation of a democracy, then I'm going to go crazy because I just can't deal with the lying.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. What's interesting is that there are people saying that now. And I think that's a relatively new thing in terms of mainstream media. And I consider what you do on X mainstream media. I mean, this is what we're on right now is essentially mainstream media. It used to be – you could call it – there's corporate-controlled media.
I agree.
And that used to be mainstream media. Mainstream media used to be CNN. It's not really anymore. Mainstream media is what – in terms of the volume consumed – more people are consuming things on Twitter, on X, than there are on anything else. They're consuming information through the internet, through YouTube, for good or for bad, whether it's correct or incorrect. They're consuming information in different forms now than ever before. So more people are saying what you're saying than have ever said it before. And when people lie and when people bullshit and gaslight, it's more offensive now than it's ever been before because there's so much access to truth that it's just – you could see it now. If you're paying attention, if you're not a boomer who only reads the newspaper, you pay attention and you see it and you go, this is horse shit.
But it's like – I guess what bothers me is that the lies aren't sophisticated.
No.
I mean, I look back over my now sort of long life – and I'm recognizing all the times that I was lied to, but, you know, I didn't know I was being lied to. They kind of pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
There's something incredibly insulting and demeaning to tell me a lie when I know it's a lie.
Yeah.
And you know I know it's a lie. We both know it's a lie, but you're demanding that I pretend to believe it?
Right.
What you're really saying is, I have no respect for you. You're like my dog.
Right.
You're a slave. Like, I'm demanding that you participate in my lie.
Right.
The lack of stealth really, does that, I'm not explaining it very well, but that really bothers me.
Well,
a
there's
lot.
No real other way to lie. You like some of these lies, like politicians. Like, did you see that conversation that AOC had with that man they brought in for the Biden case, and they were talking about what crimes, and she was like grilling this guy. What crimes did you see Joe Biden? Did he steal anything? Did he steal bread? Like, I forget what she said, but and he was trying to explain what they were, RICO crimes, and she was saying RICO is not a crime.
I saw
it's
this.
It's a category of crime. Like, okay. All right. But it's like,
tell that to the Genovese family.
Not only that, it's so dumb to say that publicly, like, well, and say it with confidence, and well, to tell a
that's
person.
That's the thing. The marriage of ineptitude and high self-esteem is like, it's really
funny.
The marker of our time. It's like, I have nothing against dumb people at all. My dogs are dumb, and I love my dogs. No, I'm serious. I don't think God cares about your intelligence, right? Only people care. And so it's not a moral category, and stupidity is not a – I mean, someone with Down syndrome, I really believe are better people than I am.
Yeah.
You know, more likely to go to heaven. So I'm not attacking her for being dumb, but the idea that a dumb person has no – the White House press secretary is in the same category, who has no idea she's dumb. Mm-hmm. She really thinks like she won the prize. Like she's the most impressive. Like I'm White House press secretary because – I'm the best talker in America. it's so crazy. And yet the smartest people I know are very often like sort of, well, I'm, you know, they have humility.
Well, also she's following Kayleigh McEnany. Is that how you say her name?
I don't really know who that is.
She was the last White House press secretary?
I know. And
you don't know who that is?
I sort
she's
of,
the GOAT.
I sort of do.
She's the GOAT. Greatest White House press secretary of all time. She's the best.
I had stopped paying close attention
Bro,
by that point.
She had all the documents. She would kill them. She whenever she would get called out, like whenever there would be a question, she'd say, that's interesting. And then she'd open the – because you said this
yes,
and your
yes.
paper said that and CNN said this. And she would call them out on stuff. And she was just really, really well prepared.
I love that.
And very articulate. She was wonderful
well, good
at the
for
job.
Her. I mean that's what it should be.
But she was operating under President Trump, you know, so obviously she's demonized.
It's just
– I can't believe you don't know who that is.
No, I don't. I
you
know who it is, but I – It's just funny.
She's the GOAT.
Well, that's. I had stopped watching all briefings by then. I used to go to
well,
the
they're
briefings
so dumb.
As
they're
a
so
kid.
Dumb.
I used. I mean, I literally would go there. I'd be in the briefing room, the former Kennedy swimming pool, and you. And the first thing you note, I mean, I was never a White House reporter, but I was a reporter, so I would go to them occasionally. And the first thing you notice is how impressed all the correspondents are to work there. I work at the White House. Work at the White House. Got my hard pass. And then the distance between that. That little credential they were so proud of, and the reality of their lives was like insane. Like they're in this tiny little room, they're being treated with total contempt by the White House staff, who thinks they're just fucking animals. You know, it's like shut up. They're eating out of vending machines, and this was a different time, right? Mm-hmm. So like when I was working as a journalist in Washington, like we went out to lunch every day at like a good restaurant and charge it to the company. And like with your sources, we're like, we had lunch every single day, like civilized people. I don't even think that exists in the world anymore, where you had time for lunch, where you weren't just so under the gun from your corporate masters that you had to like get back to work.
Right.
We ate lunch. And I remember thinking, these people don't eat lunch. They eat like a stale Mounds bar out of a vending machine. Like they bring quarters to work so they can eat. I remember thinking, your life like is you're not even human. You're just like a little puppet or something. But you're so impressed, and like all your neighbors know. You know, he works at the White House. He's in the White House press corps. And the job like wasn't even really a job. You would just like sit there and ask your question in your little assigned seat, like you're in a high school gym. It was just awful, and I just had no respect for people who did that for a living at all.
Did you ever read Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail?
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Amazing.
But that guy gave sort of that's I think probably the best window into an outsider in the political process, at least in terms of the campaign trail.
Yeah.
It's the best window to the press, the best window to the relationship that they had with the politicians, at least in the 1970s. It's an amazing book.
I was talking to a campaign reporter. I never do that anymore, but I was this week actually. And he was telling me it's like totally different. Like when I did it, you were all on a – I mean it was bad actually. It was because it just cultivated groupthink. mm-hmm. which was then leveraged by the candidate for better coverage. Like, the whole thing was kind of an op, actually. But it was at least fun. Like, you were on a charter plane, and, like, you're flying with everybody, and you hit three or four cities a day, and, like, there are cocktails on the plane, and, you know, naughty behavior, and, like, you know, they fed you, and they kind of dealt with everything for you. It was fun. It was like a road trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just, like, grim. They're all driving alone in their little rental cars to some obscure town in Iowa to sit there with no access whatsoever to the candidate, write up their little reports, and then they get back to their hotel, and they're, like, writing up more for the website, and, like, it's just it's such a bad job, actually, covering politics, that only the people who couldn't make it in any other business are doing it. It's like it's like a reverse meritocracy. It's only the most kind of pathetic power worshipers would ever do a job like that.
Mm. And, well, like critics.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly right.
Most critics want to be writers.
They're like the worst people. Just as people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, you've actually been in show business, so you've got a better experience with them, or you have a lot of experience with them. But I've known a lot of them who worked for magazines or newspapers that I worked for. And they're the kind of people who have a lot of cats and all the cats hate them. You know what I mean? They're just like the lowest. They all have some like sort of weird like wandering eye, and they're fat, and they're like super into porn, and totally isolated from everybody. I actually worked for one of them for a while, who was a critic for the New York Post. A guy called John Podhartz, and he was one of the weirdest, most unhappy people I've ever met in my life. And he would come into my office occasionally, and he would rub his – he had a really hairy back, and he would rub it against the door frame and, like, say these kind of obscure – he was stupid, but he didn't know that he was – I mean, he was actually kind of dumb, but he didn't know it, and he would – kind of philosophize. I was like 10 years younger, and I was his captive, so he would just like lecture me as he was rubbing against the doorframe. And one time we went out to lunch, and we all had drinks, of course. This is like mid-90s. He didn't really drink, but he ordered this drink with like an umbrella, and it had a piece of watermelon on the rim of the glass. And he took the watermelon and ate it, and then he ate the rind. I'll never forget that, watching him eat the rind and thinking, of course this guy's a critic.
You know,
that was his true love. He was editing this magazine, but like his real interest was in writing about movies. And they're just sad people who wind up doing
that. Did you ever read, Siskel and Ebert? Did you ever read when Roger Ebert, wrote a screenplay?
No.
It's very bizarre. It's really sexual, very strange. It's supposed to be terrible.
Of course,
I've read passages in it, but
it's terrible.
But I remember going, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, they're like, not creative. They're creative adjacent.
Well, they don't have anything to contribute.
That's what I'm saying. They don't have creative power, right? Yeah. So they're mad about that.
They probably could figure it out if they had a different mindset. I think creativity isn't in everybody. It's just a matter of how
100% it's in everybody. It just requires honesty.
Yeah.
And the impediment to creativity is lying.
Sure. And yeah, I used to say that about joke thieves, that one of the real problems with joke thieves is when they get caught and then they have to write their own material. And the problem is they don't understand the language. They just know how to say the sounds. Like, if you told me what to say in French, I can't speak French, but if you told me what to say and I practice it and I said it right, you'd think, wow, that guy fucking speaks French.
Yes.
So that's what comedy's like. So if you got a guy who knows how to repeat other people's jokes, but he doesn't know how to create them. See, comedy's one of the rare things where someone, you get a guy like Shane Gillis, that guy writes his own stuff. He edits it, he thinks it out in his head, he performs it, he produces it, he changes the order of things.
I love that.
It's a complete – everybody does it pretty much the same way. There's a few guys that hire writers, and that's honorable. There's nothing wrong with hiring a writer. And it's also – it gives jobs to other comics, because some comics are just really good writers, and they're not so good at performing. And so people will work on stuff. They'll collaborate on stuff. Like Chris Rock would do this thing where he would hire comics – and they didn't write the jokes for him, but they would be like guys he would bounce stuff off. So he would have his ideas, he would go on stage, and then after his set, they would all meet. and they would talk about the set. And, you know, guys would have taglines like, you could say this. Oh, great. And they write that down. They're adding. So it's a collaboration. So you have the master, you have Chris Rock, who is so open-minded and intelligent and humble that he brings in other masters and says, tell me what I'm doing wrong. Tell me what I could change. Tell me what I can make better.
Good for
him.
And
they work together. And then there's people that have people that are essentially ghostwriters. They hire comics to write jokes for them. They pretend they're theirs, and they don't really write them at all. So that's another level, which is also honorable.
Does anyone who does that get successful?
I don't know. Not top shelf. They get close. They do well. There's people that have people write for them, and they do well. But they're not the guy that everybody goes to. They're not Dave Attell. They're not the guy that everybody goes to see. They're not the, like, Dave Attell's the guy that comics go to see when he's in town.
Yes.
Like, he's a master. You watch him. He's Yoda. You're like, Jesus Christ. Like, how is he so good? Well, he's so good because he writes every day. Because he's sitting with fucking a pack of cigarettes and a cup of coffee every morning writing things in a notebook. And he's practicing every day. He goes on stage constantly. And he's just... It's that Japanese term kaizen, where you take this one thing you just refine it to its ultimate mastery. That's what he's doing. So these guys who pretend to be that and steal jokes and then they get caught, then their material drops off a cliff. It's so obvious.
Because they're frauds.
Yeah, also because the very thing that allows you to steal someone's jokes, that's an ego thing. That's a, like, I want the laughs. I want to be the man or the woman. I want to be the fucking one up there showing everybody, oh, look how amazing this person is.
That's right.
Look how amazing. That's the opposite mindset that's required for creativity. So creativity is not about you. Creativity is about the ideas. Creativity is about things. Creativity is about, how does this concept work with these other concepts? How do I get it in the most digestible form? If I was an audience member, what would it be like to feel this? What's the best way to introduce it? What's the way to make it so that people don't think that I'm being mean, that I have a point, or that I've thought this through? This is not just a flippant thing. Like, you're allowing someone, when someone's on stage, you're allowing that person almost to think for you. Like, you're like, take me on a ride. Like, I'll give you my mind. I'm not gonna be thinking what I would do. I'm just gonna let you think for me. If that person's not doing a good job of that, if it's clunky, if it's shitty, if the transitions suck, if the way, then it just interrupts this hypnotism that you've put on me. This hypnosis. Now I'm not letting you think for me.
But it's also inherently fraudulent.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm giving control of my mind over to someone who is himself under the control of somebody else. Do you know what I mean?
If you're stealing?
No, if I'm in the audience.
Right.
And I would say this also goes for ideas, for commentary. You know, that's not funny, but that's real.
Right.
And you see it a lot. I've seen it a lot.
Yeah, you see bullshit a lot.
Well, the number of people who are totally not controlled, who are really saying what they actually believe with no weird agenda that they're not telling you about, is pretty small.
Yeah.
And I just have noticed that a lot recently, particularly on the question of wokeness and free speech. There are a lot of people who are like on your side because they're for free speech, who are not actually for free speech at all, who are pushing a very specific foreign policy agenda, for example, and using another issue to lower your defenses and let themselves into your brain. And I think that's really sinister, really, really, really sinister. And it's becoming more obvious now. Like, if you're for free speech, then you're just for free speech because you support the principle. The content of the speech is not that interesting to you. The fact that a sovereign human being has a right to express himself because he's not a slave – he's a citizen and a human being. Like, that's what matters.
Yeah.
And if all of a sudden you, like, become famous, like, I'm for free speech, and then you support silencing people who articulate opinions you disagree with, like, you're a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of a sinister fraud.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because that's the business I'm in, I've really noticed that. Have you noticed this?
Yes. And that's also the same kind of thing when you hear them talk. If you hear someone talk that's saying something that's kind of horseshit, it resonates with you that's what you've seen.
You had a moment
before
with Barry Weiss on your show that went everywhere. I saw a clip of it. I never saw the show itself, but she was going on about she was posing as one thing, and then you pressed her. You're like, well, hold on a second. What do you mean by that? You just attacked somebody. And she had no idea what she was talking about. And it became really clear to me watching that, that completely changed my view of Barry Weiss forever. I was like, oh, this, she's a fraud, actually. This person's not honest at all. Like, she has a very specific agenda. That's all she cares about. The rest of this stuff is just a is a kind of sleight of hand maneuver.
You're talking about the thing with Tulsi Gabbard?
That's correct.
Yeah, she called her a toady and she didn't know what that meant.
Well, but she had no idea. Like, Tulsi Gabbard had straight outside the lines on some Syria or something.
Uh-huh.
And Barry Weiss was, you know, going through the files in her head, like, what does she have to believe? And she was aware that, you know, Tulsi Gabbard had somehow violated that in a way that no one's willing to say, like, in detail to fully articulate. What did Tulsi Gabbard do wrong? No one will tell you. She's just bad.
Yeah.
And then what that revealed about Barry Weiss is she's completely dishonest. Like, she's a liar, actually. You can't – by the way, if you attack somebody, particularly personally, and can't explain why you're attacking the person, like, that's not acceptable. You're a dishonest person if you can't explain why.
I think it's a common thing that people do in private, and they get accustomed to speak – like, we're talking like we're talking in private. We're just two people talking.
Right.
So people get accustomed to saying things without being able to back them up. You know, like, oh, he's a vaccine denier.
Well, I've done a ton of that in my life.
Yeah, I have
and
as well.
Because I'm an asshole. So it's like, I just don't like that person. Okay.
I have as well. But what I'm saying is, I don't know how much time Barry Weiss had spent doing podcasts before that.
Well, she'd spent – look, I'm just saying, like,
but
you know,
I think
it's important to be honest about what your agenda is.
I think she is honest. I think she is honest. And I really like her.
Yeah.
I like
well,
talking
I'm not
to her.
Against,
she's a very intelligent
not
person.
Not against her personally.
I just think that was a mistake. And I think you're allowed to do that and hopefully learn from that. And don't do that anymore. Don't say a thing that you – and I've done that. I've definitely done that. I've said a thing, and I wasn't really exactly sure what I was talking about.
Oh, my gosh. I do that every day, yeah. And I may have just done it with Barry Weiss, so let me be a lot more specific about what I mean. If your agenda is neocon politics, which is her agenda, just say so. Don't pretend to be a defender of free speech as a principle, which is what she does.
How is she a defender of neocon politics?
Barry Weiss?
Yeah, like what specifically?
Well, anyone, including me and Tulsi Gabbard, who thinks that America shouldn't be funding wars that don't help America, she will attack as a traitor to America or whatever it takes. And so no, that's her main interest, which is fine. And by the way, I actually have friends who I disagree with really strongly on this question who believe in neocon politics. Doesn't mean they're terrible people or I hate them or I'm not friends. I'm still friends with them. But they're very direct about it. This is what I care about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. You know,
right.
I really care about bird hunting and fly fishing and or whatever. I can,
right,
you,
right,
and you
right.
don't. That's totally cool. But be honest about it. So if your job is to defend the right of free people to say what they really believe, then go ahead and defend it. And if somebody is not allowed to speak or fired from his job for having an opinion that you disagree with, defend him anyway. I just interviewed a guy who is a black nationalist socialist, okay? So I'm obviously not much of a black nationalist. I don't know if you're aware of that, but I'm not. And I'm not a socialist either. But this guy is facing prison time under the Biden DOJ because he said things they don't like about foreign policy. And I just interviewed the guy for an hour, and it was like, I'm – because on principle, you should be able to say what you think, period.
What is this gentleman's name?
He was actually a – it turns out I, like, loved him. And I'm embarrassed. I can't – he's a member of a – pretty small black nationalist socialist group. It's like the Revolutionary Black Nationalists or something like that. They're
uh-huh.
out of Southwest Florida. And he's literally facing prison for repeating Russian disinformation. He's not even accused of doing anything. He's accused of saying things the Biden DOJ doesn't like. Well, in a
– What were these things that he said?
Repeating Russian propaganda.
About
the invasion of Ukraine. And his point was, well, there's a backstory here, which is that NATO has been moving eastward since 1991, and that's a massive threat to Russia. Missiles on their border from a hostile power is a threat, and the Biden administration accelerated that, and in response, Putin invaded eastern Ukraine. Now, you can disagree with that, but that's hardly a crackpot view, by the way. I think that's actually true, but even if you don't agree that it's true, that's not – you don't have to be a paid propagandist from the Kremlin to say that.
Right.
I have said it. I'm not a paid propagandist.
Is this a gentleman?
That's him right there.
Four Americans from a Black Empowerment organization work with Russian intelligence to spread propaganda, feds
yes,
say.
To spread propaganda. Now, propaganda, first of all, you know, there's a lot of propaganda.
But scroll up a little on that, Jamie, so I can read what this is saying.
It's covered up.
Oh, okay.
Right? One so of that guy is that yeah, guy right there.
Okay, subscribe real quick.
Yeah, the People's Democratic Uhuru Movement in St. Petersburg. So
he contacted, he spoke with someone in Russia. They spoke with people in Russia, and then
he's
he
repeated. No. He is being, he's charged with felonies. The FBI raided his house. The first thing they did was cover up the security cameras. And they went in there and arrested. They got raided by the FBI.
Okay.
Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service allegedly weaponized our First Amendment rights, freedoms, Russian citizens, to divide Americans and interfere elections in the U.S., says Assistant Attorney General Matthew Olson. Now, first of all, weaponized our First Amendment rights? No. Your First Amendment rights are never a crime.
Right.
They're God-given. The government did not bestow them. You were born with them as a free person, period. And the First Amendment simply says you can't interfere with their exercise. That's it. And in this, they are. And I looked at – I read this and I thought – I reached out to this guy, by the way.
Matthew Olson?
No, I wish. Matthew Olson would never do my show. I mean, the guy whose salary I pay as a U.S. citizen? No, he would never speak to me.
Listen, look at that quote. Russia's Foreign Intelligence Services allegedly weaponized our First Amendment rights, freedoms Russia denies its own citizens to divide Americans and interfere in elections in the United States. That – you got to – like – why are you saying that? Say what happened.
Well, but nothing happened. So that's the thing. So I'm reading this. Someone sent it to me, and I'm like, okay, clearly there's a crime here. Like they were found with, I don't know, mortar shells, or they were – I mean usually the government makes up – they put kiddie porn on your computer at least to discredit you. There's no underlying crime other than they said something that the foreign policy establishment of the United States disagrees with. Okay. That's not a crime by definition. And this guy is facing life in prison. And it looks to me, because Barry Weiss has not defended him, I think this guy is likely to spend the rest of his life in prison. And I'm like, this is crazy.
The rest of his life in prison?
Yes.
Okay, hold it. This is the thing.
I think he's 83.
How do you say his name?
Yeshitela?
Yeshitela and three other U.S. citizens, Penny Joanne Hess, Jesse Neville and Augustus C. Romaine Jr. are charged with conspiracy to defraud U.S. Hess. Defraud the United States. Hess, Yeshitela, and Neville are also charged with impersonating agents of a foreign government.
Okay. They say to defraud the United States. So defraud suggests theft of something of value, right?
Right.
If I defraud you, I steal your money. There's no allegation of that at all. And I actually read the charges. The only allegation is they said things that the U.S. government, the Biden administration, doesn't like. That's it. And because they're unpopular and they have views that are considered, quote, fringe, you know, like crazy black nationalists, nobody wants to defend them. And my only point is not that I'm like such a principled person. This seems very obvious to me. You can't allow that. You absolutely cannot allow that if you believe in the First Amendment, in the freedom of free people to say what they think.
So this implication is they're saying that they were recruited by the FSB. So it says prosecutors said Ionov operated an entity called the Anti-Globalization Movement of Russia that was used to carry out its U.S. influence efforts overseen by the Russian intelligence service known as FSB. They recruited U.S.-based organizations to help sway elections, make it appear there was a strong support in the U.S. for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and backed efforts such as the 2015 United Nations petition to decry the genocide of African people in the U.S. according to the indictment. Backed efforts.
What does that mean?
Look at that. Like it's negative that to back efforts to such as the 2015 United Nations petition to decry the genocide of African people. But what? Just look at that statement. Backed efforts such as a thing to decry genocide. The United Nations petition of 2015 to decry the genocide of African people. In the U.S., according to the indictment.
Okay, so the real misinformation and propaganda is in the charging documents, actually. the real liars here are the Biden DOJ officials who did this, and they're dangerous. They're criminals, in my opinion. But if you read it carefully, you will see that the only crime is having opinions that the people in charge didn't like.
And were they in contact with people from Russia?
Yeah, I think they went over to Russia for some conference. So
they went over to Russia.
But the way this typically works is they say, well, you went to a country against which we've imposed sanctions.
Right.
And you violated the sanctions regime in some way. Like, that's how they get you. They're not even alleging that. They're just saying, you said things that we don't like that, by the way, a foreign government we don't like agrees with.
But that's that not, they learned those when they went over to Russia?
On the internet. I guess it doesn't matter where they learned them. I would – because I've talked to the guy and I've seen what they wrote, the opinions that they expressed – I don't – you know, the genocide of African peoples in America. I don't even know what that means. I guess I don't agree with that. But their views on Russia I generally agree with because I think they're true. And so does Jeff Sachs and a lot of other non-crazy, non-black nationalists who probably agree with the basic framework of their position. But whether we agree or not is not relevant.
Right.
All that matters is in a free country, which this was when I grew up, you have the right to any opinion you want. You do not have the right to hurt people. You don't have the right to steal from them. You don't have the right to defraud people. But you certainly, foremost, have the right to any opinion you want, no matter what the people in charge think of it. In fact, you have that right as a bulwark against tyranny by the people in charge. Like, that's the only thing that keeps this country free is my right to have any opinion I want. And this guy is going to jail for his opinions. And you know, it's so crazy that I kept thinking, like, is there something that I'm missing? Like, it does seem a little fringe, this group. I'd never heard of them. I'm not saying the money, okay? They must have done something. Nope, nothing. And you should see the video of the FBI raid. It's unbelievable. They sent like – it's on the internet. It's on X. I have the video on there. They sent like 40 armed agents with automatic weapons to this guy's office and his house. Like, no exaggeration. It was a full-blown, like, we're arresting El Chapo type thing. For this guy, he's like an 83-year-old Army veteran. It's outrageous. And I really find it baffling that nobody who's, like, against woke culture or whatever will touch it. And the reason they won't touch it is because their foreign policy views, in general, are more important to them than their views on speech and the First Amendment, their views on America.
Well, if you step out of line, right, so the ideology is that we must support Ukraine.
Right.
So this is – that Russia has a point. This is what they're saying. So Russia was very upset about the movement of the weapons closer to their borders, the joining NATO, all the stuff that was the hard red lines that Putin had already set. Like if Russia would – definitely do something if Ukraine joined NATO. We all knew that. So if you deviate from that, you're going to be in trouble. So better just ignore it. Because you can't – you clearly, if you look at who these people are, I mean these are people that would be supported by the left wholeheartedly.
Well, they are. I mean it's like the revolutionary socialism.
Yeah.
They're not at CPAC this
year. But the left has to ignore it because then
100%
it conflicts with this other part of the ideology.
Well, the categories right and left are just like – now they're actually ridiculous.
They're ridiculous.
They don't mean anything.
They're ridiculous.
In fact, we've moved past the point where they don't mean anything. They do mean something. They are propaganda instruments designed to cloak the truth from the rest of us.
Uh-huh.
That in fact, there's agreement, not disagreement, at the center of power. They all agree on the things that matter. And those are the economy and foreign policy because that's where the money is. There's no effort to, say, rein in the credit card companies, which if you really cared about the country, you'd say, but people are really suffering. Okay, they don't have enough money to live. Kids can't not only not buy houses, they can't afford rent. And why is that? And one of the main reasons is because they're paying like close to 20% interest on their credit cards. And okay, we just imagine that in a free market, that's a good thing. Tell me why that's a good thing. Who benefits from that? Why are we for that again? I'm not for that. I think the credit card companies are villains and they send credit cards to kids at school and get them hooked on this. I think it's totally wrong. And if you said that in the U.S. Congress, people would look at you like you had three heads. Like, what? they just don't care because they all agree that our current economic system and our current foreign policy assumptions are good. So that's not a two-party system. That's a one-party system, and it doesn't serve the interest of the country. And my position is super simple. The only country I have an emotional attachment to is the United States. That's it. I like lots of countries. I like almost all countries, actually. I've been to a lot of them. I like them all. But the only one I feel emotional about is the United States because I live here. I was born here. My kids are here. It's my country. And most of the people in our foreign policy conversation do not feel that way. So that distorts it really dramatically. And there are also a lot of them are violence worshipers. Like they get off on war. They get off on hurting people and on the power that imbues them with. And I think, you know, the Liz Cheney model, you know what I mean? Like someone like Liz Cheney, who's got like a really sad and barren personal life. A lot of them are this way, weird personal life, failed personal life. Like they don't have people who love them. They don't have kids who respect them. And so Adam Kinzinger or whatever, they're all kind of the same. The more broken they are inside, the more focused they are on like war and foreign policy because it gives them a feeling of power and strength and success. Like I can't get my wife to respect me. I can't get my kids to listen to me. I can't pass any meaningful domestic agenda. But what I can do is bomb the living shit out of a foreign country. And there is this – it's not true for all of them, but for a lot of them, there is this syndrome that drives their behavior. But whatever the reason, it's totally disconnected from what's good for the country. And if you run America, you have one job, and that's improve America, period. They don't see it that way. And I don't think the system can continue because it's too distorted. It's not serving its original purpose at all.
So what was it that these guys said that made this raid possible?
They said Russia – and I don't want to speak for them. Like I interview – anyone who wants to see it can interview. And I just want to say again, like one of the cool things about this moment that I did not anticipate, or there's all this sad stuff happening. I know that you probably experience this all the time. Is like finding not only common ground with people you thought you had nothing in common with at all – but also like liking them, you know, like I actually liked the guy. I'm sure we disagree on a million things, probably mad at white people. I am a white person, whatever. But like in my conversation, I was like, I like this guy, you know, he's honest and he's sincere. He's principled. He was a veteran, you know, but whatever. No, I really think what they said was what I have said and a lot of people have said, which is there was a reason for this invasion. I personally think the invasion was a bad idea. It didn't help anybody. I'm against war. I'm sad the war's ongoing. But they were pushed to this by a more powerful country, which would be the United States of America, with the threat of including Ukraine in NATO. It's really simple. And right before the invasion, days before the invasion, they send poor Kamala Harris, who has no idea what day it is, to the Munich Security Conference, an area she knows nothing about, no experience in it at all. And they send her there for one purpose, which is to announce at a press briefing with all the cameras rolling to Zelensky right there. She says, we want you to join NATO. What? No other NATO members were clamoring for Ukraine. It didn't even qualify for NATO membership. Why would you say that? When Putin's got troops massed on the Ukrainian border, you send your vice president to the Munich Security Conference with the world watching and say this that no one even really wants? Why would you do that? To provoke war, obviously. What's the other reason? And it was scripted. Like Kamala Harris is not freeballing stuff. Like she's saying what she's told to say. Obviously, it's not her area. She doesn't know anything about this stuff. She was told to say that. But why? To provoke a war, obviously. So that was my read. I said that on Fox News. Not a lot of people liked it, but it just seemed obvious to me. I'm not making excuses for Putin. Please. I want to protect the United States, and I think this war really hurts the United States. Like my motives are always right out there. Anyway, I think they said a species of that, something like that. And last thing I'll say is that why was the reaction so strong? Because it was true. They don't care if you lie. No one in power cares if you lie.
But a lot of people
are saying –
they only
care when you tell the truth.
A lot of people are saying those things and they're not getting arrested.
Because he's like some black nationalist guy in St. Petersburg. Like who cares? We can do – who's going to defend him? Nobody. He's some wacko. He's some like 80-year-old guy who's like been in the like fringe left movement for the past 50 years, you know, like new Huey Newton and Stokely Carmichael. He's like a relic of the past and like he doesn't have a constituency. He doesn't care. The modern Democratic Party hates him. he hates them. And the Republican Party is like, black nationalism? No thanks. So he has no constituency. They're never going to, like, you could say that. And what are they going to do to you? You know, nothing, because they can't. But this guy, yeah, crush him, kill him. And that's exactly what they're doing. And I really think, not to be like a 70s liberal about it, if you let the weak get crushed, it's bad. It's super bad. You need to protect the weak. And this guy's weak.
And so you think they're making an example out of him with this?
Yeah, and they can. They have all this power. This
I just don't understand why they would move so many people, why they would get so many agents, why they would do this so publicly for one guy's opinion or one group of people's opinion.
Well, I don't know. I mean, why did
medieval
kings hang the heads of people they executed from the gates?
Right, but it feels like there should be more to it. Like, what did they say? So the problem is you're telling me. I know. The problem is that, I mean, I'm steel manning this. So the problem is that they went over to Russia and they talked with people in Russia, and then they're saying these things. Is that the problem?
They're not charged with that. They're not charged with going to Russia.
But do you think that's the motivation behind it, because they went over there?
Just a different article has a quote from him.
Okay.
Yeah, they are not – at least when I interviewed him, they had not been charged with taking money from Russia.
So it says they've been accused of us – they've accused us of taking money from Russia. Yeshitela said yesterday at a news conference on July 29th, we've never taken any money from Russian government. But I'm not saying that because I'm morally opposed to taking money from the Russians or anyone else who wants to support the struggles for black people. Don't tell us what we can't – don't tell us that we can't have friends that you don't like. He accused the U.S. government of seeking to use the APSP as a pawn in its proxy war with Russia. The unsubstantiated allegation that opponents of the war are co-conspirators with a foreign power are intended to bolster the phantom of a Russian boogeyman in the public consciousness. The escalating military aggression by the U.S. against Russia and China is already being accompanied by increasing repression and an attempt to criminalize left-wing opposition to the unpopular war.
Well, exactly.
So they're accusing him of taking money from Russia.
They're not. They're not charging him. So here's the distinction, which is like really, really important. So there are two levels on which the Department of Justice in all administrations acts. There's the level of propaganda, like what do we want people to think? And there's the level of law. What are we charging someone with? And you have to ignore the first and pay very close attention to the second. So we have a legal system, we have laws, and you can't actually go to jail unless you violate one under the terms of our system. And so ignore what they're saying about you. Joe Rogan sucks, he's a bad man. But in the end, I'm busting you for double parking. And so you're not a bad man, you're a double parker under the law. And so if you look at the charges against these guys, they're not charged with violating sanctions regulations. They are charged with totally amorphous, quote, crimes, like defrauding the U.S. government, not for money, but for like defrauding it, like, I guess, counter signaling it. Sending a message publicly that they don't like. I mean, there's no crime. Look it up. Except speaking. And I think that's a precedent that we don't want to live with.
No, no doubt.
All right. I'm going to take a leak.
Yeah, let's take a leak. We'll be right back. We're going to pee. Tucker and I are going to pee together. Yeah, well, that's the confronting of reality. You're forced to examine your beliefs and why you came to those beliefs in the first place.
No, that is the beauty of this moment, though.
It is.
People are living intentionally much more, and it's also just much more interesting. It's not just, you know, it's less shallow than it was, for sure.
I think so. I think it's more nuanced. People have more at least the people that are paying attention have a more nuanced perspective. But then you have the people that are in the echo chambers that are just digging their heels in even more. And you could spot them easily because they...
Well, they're missing out because there's nothing more liberating than admitting you were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is like the moment of liberation.
Right.
And that's the basis of religion. It's the basis of AA. It's the basis of anything that improves you as a person is honestly admitting to other people, not just to yourself, that like, wow, I got that wrong.
Yeah.
And then you're free because then you don't have to hide it anymore.
Right. Very important.
And it's a beautiful thing. And that is like changing your mind. I always notice this covering politics that, you know, a candidate would be like, I've got him on tape saying 10 years ago something different. And no one ever asked my opinion, but I always wanted to say, why don't you say you're absolutely right? And the country's a lot different from what it was 10 years ago. And so my opinions changed too. Like, why wouldn't they? Because I'm not a freaking robot or a liar.
Also, I used to think this because of that, and now I realize I was wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah, which
How
is
How great is that?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's part of being a human. It's not being a flip-flopper.
It's the best part of being a human.
Well, this is an interesting time for that because you see people that won't do that. And you could recognize them easily because they're the first people to throw out insults. The first thing to do when they describe you, they'll describe you in an insulting way, and then they'll say what they disagree with you about. They'll say something hard. They try to define you. You far right, white supremacist, racist.
Oh, been there.
Yeah, they throw it all at you. And then they say what you said.
It's so funny. I got called racist and white supremacist so many times. But when I first was called that, I mean, it really stung, you know, a lot because just of where I grew up and how I grew up. And those are like the worst things you could ever call somebody. And so I actually like paused for a moment and thought, am I? Like, which I think it's fair to ask yourself, like, am I a white, whatever that, I never figured out what that was. Am I a racist? Not really. And I thought, really, the people I dislike most are almost all white liberals, actually. So
you're racist against white people.
No, but like, no, I am white. My kids are white. I'm not against white people. I like white people. But no, it's not that. It's that. So a reporter once called me about this. Oh, you've been called racist. I was like, no, actually, I really dislike you. If I were to sort of narrow down my bigotries, it's like people like you, I just think you're disgusting. I really mean it, too.
Racist.
Okay.
All right. Well, it's a thing, you know.
I don't think that works as much anymore.
It doesn't work. No. Well, I think a lot of the things that you overuse, eventually people realize, like, oh, you're yelling wolf again. Yeah.
Well, of course. And when people get hit with it and don't disappear, then it becomes obvious that it lacks power.
Well, it's also you're trying to like use these words to define someone, especially someone like you that has so many hours and hours of talking about things, like to try this reductionist perspective of someone to reduce them to this ultimately very negative thing and not say that they're a human being. And also the fact that it's done by the people that want to think of themselves as compassionate and kind, which is the most bizarre. The left is so aggressively incompassionate. Like, they're so aggressively unkind with
letting people die of drug ODs on the sidewalk. That's compassion? No, it's
that
not.
Whole thing is fucking crazy.
Well, it's cruelty, actually.
It is. And it's also when you find, do you know Kolyan Nuwara is?
I know him.
Yeah, great guy. He opened my eyes to the homelessness thing. We had him on the podcast, and he was explaining how he was in San Francisco, and he was like, what is this? Is like, they don't have any money for this? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Like, no. There's a whole business behind it.
Of course.
It. And these people that are running this homelessness initiative or whatever the fuck they call it, they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, some of them $250,000 a year.
Imagine making money off the homeless.
And not doing a goddamn thing.
But what's so funny is I do think the root of their power and the one thing they're good at is just charging the moral high ground and taking it in the first moments of the battle.
Yeah.
They just run up to the moral high ground and are like, we've got this. This is ours. And they'll protect that at all costs. And it's like that's kind of all they have is this self-righteousness. And if you can puncture that, it's like you're getting rich from the homeless, actually.
Yeah.
And is there anything more disgusting than that? It's some junkie who's dying in misery outside the convention center in San Francisco, and you're making money on that?
They're essentially using those people as a battery to expand the power of government.
Yeah, and their own personal advantage.
Yeah, they're expanding government. They're making more government employees. Now there's tons of people that are working on the homelessness problem, air quotes. And, you know, they probably all have blue hair and they talk nonsense. And nothing's getting done, and no one's being punished for it. But when they did that study where they said that they had no data, like, how are you – what? You can't say whether or not it's doing anything?
Yeah.
How'd you spend $24 billion?
But why are they not treated as, like, the most reprehensible people in our society?
I think there's too many things to think about. Yeah. And I think most people, unlike you and I, aren't even paying attention to it. They're paying attention to the fact that the tents are there. They're paying attention that if you go to Los Angeles, it's a fucking zombie apocalypse. But what they're not paying attention to is what is going on. How many people are making money? I didn't even know until Kolyan explained it to us I had no idea. I thought it was just they don't have any money. They don't put any money in it, and they let these people sleep there.
Oh, no.
No, there's actual money.
No, there are
money.
All these parasites.
Yeah,
no.
Parasites. Government parasites.
Of course.
Those are real.
Of course.
And, you know, this whole idea of I've created so many jobs. Like, what jobs? Are they government jobs that are just bullshit? Because there's a lot of those.
What's crazy to me, just having spent most of my life in Washington, is how close this is to the lawmakers physically. So the U.S. Capitol sits across from something called Union Station, which is a really beautiful train station, right on Capitol Hill. And so to get into the Capitol, when there's a massive homeless city there, people dying of drug ODs right there. And so to get to work every day, lawmakers have to like step over the bodies of fellow Americans dying, living outdoors, shitting in the bushes, addicted to drugs, which is hell, okay? And they have to ignore that on their way to creating utopia in some foreign country. And you're like, does it ever occur to you that that's disgusting? That
it's
your primary
so
duty is to the drug addict, your fellow American, you're doing nothing? And you're telling me how we're going to make Eastern Europe into, you know, this brave new world? I don't know. I just can't get past that. I think I'm not super sensitive or aware or anything. I'm not super anything, really. I'm pretty ordinary, but I think I would notice. I would. I was like walking into vote on Ukraine aid. I'd be like, shit, there are like five junkies on the street. Like, maybe we should do something for them?
No. Yeah. Yeah, it's very bizarre. It's bizarre that they can rationalize it, or at least that they don't get called out by all their people. And this idea that it's compassionate. You have compassion to leave these people and to give them aid and to help them and give them clean needles.
But then you've got to think, like, maybe there's something bigger going on, actually.
Mm.
Because there's no – yes, there's an entire sector of the economy now that feeds off of human misery. The drug treatment centers that don't work, the homeless advocates who create more homeless, the, you know, migrant workers, you know, American-born aid agencies, workers who – you know, increase illegal immigration and gang activity. You know, this is all this, you know, people are making money off this. The arms manufacturers that help kill people in foreign countries, et cetera, et cetera. There's a VIG in all of that. It's a scam. It's a grift, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, there's something more. Like, there are a lot of people who seem to be just, like, for evil for its own sake. And you're like, maybe all the, like, crazy talk about a spiritual war of, like, good and evil – maybe there's something to that. Maybe that's not an illusion. Maybe that's like everyone else has always thought that. Maybe.
There are certainly forces that have evil consequences that exist.
But they act on people from the outside. And you feel it also on the other side. I mean, people are better than they naturally are sometimes. Like you feel compassion for people or true empathy for someone or you really want to help someone. There's no advantage to you at all. Like, why are you doing that? It's almost right. Like you're being acted on by good. And all of us have known those moments where we just are cruel for the sake of it, hurt someone for the sake of it. What's that? There's no advantage to us. That's evil acting on us. And I think we're seeing it at scale. And like, I grew up in the most secular world you could ever grow up in, Southern California in the 70s and 80s, and in a very secular family. And I've never really paid much attention to that. And all of a sudden, a lot of people I know who had similar childhoods to mine, similar life experiences are like, maybe there is like a supernatural realm. Maybe there's more than just like what we can see and feel. Maybe life is more than just ordering shit on Amazon. Maybe there's like a purpose. Maybe there is this battle between good and evil around us that we can't see, but that we do experience a lot.
It seems like it's always been a narrative throughout human history. It's always been this recognition. Carl's over there snoring. I don't have my headphones on so I can hear him.
Oh, you're snorting or snoring?
Snoring. Carl snoring. Oh, Carl the dog.
Carl the dog.
Carl the dog.
I
he
like
snores.
Carl the dog.
He's the best, but he snores when he sleeps because he's a little French bulldog.
He's a sporty little bulldog.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
He's the best. Dogs don't get cuter. They might be as cute, but they don't get any cuter than Carl.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I've got some pretty good looking dogs. I will say.
Yeah, I have a beautiful dog. I have a golden retriever, but he's not as cute as Carl. Carl's a different thing.
Don't tell him that.
He knows. He doesn't like Carl. Well, he doesn't hate Carl, but he like ignores him. He thinks of Carl as a thief of attention only.
Which he is.
Yeah.
Fair.
So we've always, human beings have always at least believed that there are forces of good and evil, and that they that's what exorcisms are about, right? The idea that you're possessed,
yes.
That you're possessed by evil. There's always been this thought that there's good and evil. But when did you start considering that and thinking that that's a real? Because weren't you at one point in time, weren't you a Grateful Dead head?
Oh, yeah. I listened to them this morning, yeah.
You used to travel around with them?
Yeah.
How old were you when that was going on?
I went to my first Dead show in December of 1984, so I was 15, at, speaking of the San Francisco
15?
Civic Center. Yeah,
wow.
The New Year's shows, so they've always played in Oakland, but one year they played at the in San Francisco. And so we were in Tahoe over Christmas, and for some reason my dad was gone. I don't really know where. So my brother and I drove illegally from Tahoe in the family vehicle to downtown San Francisco.
How old was your brother?
13.
So you drove? Or
yeah,
he drove?
I drove.
15, you drove?
Yeah.
Wow.
From Tahoe. So it was a couple hours. And I remember being on the freeway like, rah!
At 15.
Well, we had a pretty different kind of childhood. But anyway, we didn't.
Is that have... you?
Yeah, it's me on the left.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how that picture is hanging in my barn, and I've never, you know, I don't release any pictures of myself or family or anything like that. And somebody came to my barn and took a picture of that. It's hanging next to my sink and put it on the internet.
Wow.
So that's my brother Buckley on the right. That picture was taken. So my dad was a reporter in San Francisco in the 60s and pretty well-known reporter. And that was in the 80s when I was in school and we were home for Christmas vacation, and he had covered the Grateful Dead. He knew the Grateful Dead. My dad did. So they were in his office. They like came through DC and they like called him, and they came over to his office. Jerry came over to his office, and my dad's like, I've got Jerry Garcia here. You guys should come down. So my brother and I, we lived in Georgetown, and we had a Vespa. Remember those?
Yeah.
And we drove our Vespa. It was freaking cold out. I'll never forget that. We drove our Vespa down to 6th and E or whatever, where my dad's office was, and there was Jerry. I'd never met him before. He was missing the middle finger of his right hand, famously. You know, the famous handprint, Grateful Dead handprint. And but when he shook his hand, you could feel it collapse, kind of, because he didn't have that middle finger. But anyway, so my brother and I drove to this to the New Year's show. It was actually a couple nights before New Year's. And we didn't have tickets, of course. And we were in the park across from there, and we were, you know, whatever, doing the, you know, whatever the things that people do at dead shows. And we were pretty freaking out of it. And this guy comes up out of nowhere and puts a ticket right in my face and goes, here, and hands me a ticket. So my brother was extremely out of it. I mean, he was, you know, I never should have done this, but I was like, all right, man, I'm going in. All right. And I left my little brother in the park during the show, just like very, very impaired, like super, super impaired. It was completely wrong to do something like that, but I did do it. And then I went in and saw the show, kind of freaked out in the middle of it, hid in the men's room for a while. I'll never forget that. Standing on the stall smoking cigarettes.
Is it acid?
It was psilocybin mushrooms, which, by the way, I should just say, I got sober 22 years ago. I'm completely opposed to anything. Like, I don't take Advil. Like, I'm totally opposed to anything, but other than nicotine and coffee. But yeah, it was mushrooms. So we ate way too many, and started to kind of melt down a little bit. But anyway, the point is, I get out of the show. This is pre-cell phone. This is 1984, and I get out of the show, and they played actually a lot of tunes that they didn't play. They played Spoonful. Like, they didn't play Spoonful a lot. It was like a pretty obscure tune. I'd never heard it before, actually. And I couldn't find my brother, my little brother. And I'm like in charge, and you know, my closest friend and lifelong friends, talked to him this morning. And but I couldn't find him. And I was like, oh man, my brother's gone. But there he was. He appeared like an hour later. He had spent the entire show in somebody's van parked there, but he seemed undamaged, and it was great. I mean, not everything about it is great. I mean, I do think the drug thing got, you know, definitely hurt people for sure. But from my perspective, I went to a bunch, probably 50 or more shows, and really enjoyed it. And I love the fact that they had two drummers. That was a huge thing for me. I love rhythm. I think it's the basis of music. It's obviously the basis of music. I mean, instruments are cool, but they're kind of like interior design, and the architecture is rhythm, and it's the universal sound that every culture appreciates because it reflects something that's pre-existing that's in you. Everyone relates to rhythm, and I just absolutely loved the drums. And I love, they would always play, like it was called drums, actually, but they would play a section of every show. It was just drums. Bill Kreutzmann and Mickey Hart just gone crazy on the drums. They had drum circles, and I just like drums. To this day, I listen to drums, just percussion. King Sunny Ade, the great West African drummer. And anyway, whatever. So, yeah, I like the Grateful Dead a lot and still do, and I like that kind of music.
Jam music?
I like jam music. I like acoustic music. I love bluegrass and Americana. And to see that grow, to see Billy Strings become like a venue packer, you know, like Billy Strings is like a big act right now. I do feel like creativity art has been completely destroyed and eliminated in the United States. There's like, as we were saying earlier, you can't be creative if you're not honest. It's that simple. And we can't be honest, so there's no creativity. And in the visual arts and literature and architecture, it's died. But comedy is still alive, thank heaven. And music, for some reason, has escaped that and is still alive.
Yeah.
And the growth, the explosion of acoustic bluegrass, you know, the banjo, like one of the great instruments ever, is just thrilling and like a sign of life, you know, at this late stage.
Well, I think when there's social pressures and when society's in chaos, art does tend to thrive. Some kind of art.
Some art, that's right.
Comedy certainly does now. Like, comedy's never been better.
But it came close. It's an amazing time. It came close.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the walls got breached.
Whoa!
Yeah.
No, but a few years, I don't know when it was, but, you know, 8 years ago or something, it felt like, oh, wow. You know, people can't tell jokes anymore.
We kept doing it.
Well, I noticed.
Yeah.
And
yeah, we kept doing it.
You kept the little embers alive.
Yeah. Well, it was flames. It's just, you know, when you get people in a club and you take their phones away and just have them just be actual human beings and not be filming everything, right, just being completely trapped with this idea of capturing something and then putting it online, then you get to have a human experience.
You mean when people, like, live in the present,
yeah,
rather than in the future,
yeah,
or far,
yeah,
away.
That's one of the great things
through a
about
data line.
Going to a good club that uses yonder bags for your phones is that it just takes you out of it. Like, at the very least, it's a break. Like this podcast is a break for 3 hours of phones. There's no, I'm not, no one's checking phones.
I love that.
That's very rare with human beings where they can just sit down and just have conversations for long periods of time,
yes,
without being distracted by something.
Not in my house, but yeah.
It's a real problem with folks.
It's a huge problem. It's a huge problem. And the one thing I will say about my very unconventional childhood is there was a huge premium on meals and, like, eating with people. And spending 4 hours at the table was, like, totally normal in the house that I grew up in. Totally normal. In fact, it was, like, daily. And that was our primary form of entertainment and mode of communication and, you know, thing that we did for fulfillment and fun. And I still do that. I still feel that way. And we have dinner parties constantly and there are no phones and people talk and entertain each other. And it's like, it's so much more interesting. I'm not on social media, but if I were on social media, I don't think I would find that on Instagram. And I'm not attacking Instagram, but I don't think I would find that, anything like that.
No, it's definitely a lost thing.
And it's such an easy thing. It's such a fun thing.
It is a fun thing. Yeah, it's a great thing. And I think people enjoy it. I think that's also led to the rise of podcasts, too, because they don't get that in their real life. So at least they get to be a person who sits in on these conversations.
I got to say, this is not being suck-up-y, because I don't suck up ever to anyone. But the effect that podcasts have had is just incredible. And I never would have predicted that in a million freaking years.
I would have never thought it. When I first started doing this, it was in my living room with my friend Brian, and we did it on a laptop. And we had a webcam, and we were like...
With my friend Brian.
Yeah. Brian Redband of Kill Tony. You met Brian.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I just love the phrase, with my friend Brian. like every bad story, like me I was and with my friend Brian. Brian. we were down in Mexicali. And me and my friend Brian.
We just started fucking around online, and then we started eventually bringing in guests, and then we eventually got a studio, and then eventually I got, you know, a big place in L.A., like a real warehouse, and then eventually moved to Texas. It all just eventually happened.
But it was not. I mean, I was in another part of media for that whole period, and if you had asked me up until the last few years, like, the future is clearly shorter, crisper, more produced, mm-hmm. right?
Right. Everybody would have thought that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everyone did think that, including me, and I hated it. You know, I hate it. I like long form, but I was a long form magazine writer for years. So I thought that was over.
Yeah.
Not over.
Everybody thought that. Yeah. Even my friends, they were telling me how to edit my show. They're like, you should edit that. No one's going to listen to 3 hours. I'm like, then don't listen. I don't care. Do whatever you want. I'm not making any money doing this. It was just for fun.
I love that.
It was just fun for years. For years and years. I did it just with no money. There was no money in it forever.
What year, like how many years in did it start to pay for itself?
5.
That's a long time.
Yeah, long time. It took a while. I mean, it was probably existing. Yeah, but about 5 years in, then it started making money. And then it was like, oh, this is a business. I remember very clearly, I was on stage once in Chicago. I was doing the Chicago theater. And I had this story that I was going to tell. I'm like, how many people listen to the podcast? And there's 3,700 people in the place. And they went nuts. It was like, yeah. And I was like, oh. Like, I thought there was this like thing that I'm doing where, you know, a few people are paying attention. I don't even know what I never even knew what the numbers were. I didn't even care.
Just, well, they may not have been like. Could you even collect numbers accurately?
Yeah, you
then?
Could get downloads off of provider was that was with the host. You could get like download numbers from the host, and they would use that to inform ads. Like, oh, he gets X amount of downloads per month, and then they would, you know, that's when there was very few people advertising on podcasts. They're like, all right, let's give it a try.
But it's one of the great developments. Between podcasting and Billy Strings, like I'm serious, I have hope that it's not all going in the wrong direction, because you can get this view that like everything is falling apart, late Rome, just a matter of time before, you know, it really does collapse. And then you see these signs that are not minor, you know, they're significant, that like, no, people, I mean, I haven't met a person in the past year who said, you know, I thought this, but then I was reading the New York Times and I realized I was wrong. Like, not one person.
Right.
But the number of people say, I was listening to this podcast. I was listening to Rogan and da-da-da-da-da. It's like,
yeah.
Really noticeable.
Yeah, that's why it's interesting. It's interesting because you could put people in front of people and they might not even be right. It might be wrong. But at least now you're having conversations about something you would never have a conversation about before. And even if this person gets exposed as being incorrect, well, now you have a more nuanced understanding of what the subject is about and why people think incorrect things. And, you know, this idea of like platforming people is a big one today. Why would you platform that person?
First of all, platform is not a verb. And whenever they take a perfectly good noun and turn it into a verb, you know something bad is afoot.
Yeah.
Okay. Platform. Oh, you mean letting an adult human being talk?
Right.
I think that's not only allowed, I think that's the law.
Not only that, I think it's important for us. It's even important to talk to people that are completely different than you, that don't agree with you at all.
Well it's especially important.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just masturbatory.
It's interesting.
It's just you
too.
Alone getting yourself off.
But it's also interesting to know why these people think the way they think. And also, there's so many people that if you talk to them online, you'd have these horrible conversations. But if you sit down with them as an actual human being and treat them with respect and consideration, and you talk to them like a human being, and you just try to be as friendly and open and possible as possible, despite what your differences might be, you realize most people have a lot in common. A lot. More, way more in common than they don't.
But that's the secret that they're trying to hide.
Yeah.
So mind control, you know, the end stage of mind control is censorship, right? But it begins long before that. And it begins by creating false categories that wall off your willingness that prevent you from wanting to know certain things or talk to certain people. And name calling is the most obvious tool. Like, he's a crank. He's a racist. He's a whatever. Fill it in. And then you're like, I can't listen to that person. And I have to say, your willingness to platform or to have a conversation with Alex Jones, I think, was a revolutionary act, actually. Not that everything Alex Jones says is right. It's not. Not everything I say is right, or anyone says is right. But Alex Jones is an interesting person. And even if he's not interesting, he has been walled off from the rest of us.
Yeah.
Through name calling. And your willingness to be like, no, actually, we're just going to listen to Alex Jones and you can decide for yourself.
Well, Alex has been my friend for more than 20 years.
Well, exactly. But even if he – just the – yeah, but I'm sure you have other friends you haven't invited. Just like
right.
You were not allowed to talk to him. And when you hear Alex Jones talk, you may not agree with everything he says. I don't know that I do. But you definitely understand why they told you you couldn't listen to Alex Jones.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I had him as one of the first guests when I came over to Spotify.
Love that.
I was like, let's go.
What did they say?
Well, a lot of people weren't happy. We lost sponsors. It was an issue. But I think it did the job. You know, it regardless of what he said that's incorrect, clearly the Sandy Hook thing was incorrect. You know, Alex, I know Alex personally, so I know what he was going through. And, you know, everybody wants to talk about mental health, and they want to praise people for being honest about their mental health issues and support them on their mental health journey to wellness. Alex has gone through some real issues, and one of the reasons why he's gone through some issues is because that guy is uncovering real shit that's terrifying every fucking day. And he was drinking out of control, and, you know, he's just fucking constantly stressed, freaking out. And when you see so many lies and so much propaganda and so many psyops that are being done on people, you start seeing them where they don't exist. And that's what he did.
Well, and he's also channeling some stuff. You can't call 9/11 in detail because you're super informed.
Before the fact.
He called it.
Yes.
He literally called it in the summer of 2001. He said, planes will fly into the World Trade Centers and they will blame a man called Osama bin Laden. We know that he said that because he said it on tape
multiple
times. And then he said, call the White House and tell them this. Now, that's all we know about Alex Jones. Let's just say that's the fact set. How'd that happen?
Right. How did he do that?
He's channeling something.
You think
that's
so?
Super. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
There's like no other. I mean, tell me how he did it otherwise. I've asked him about it. How did you do that at length? He had dinner in my barn recently. We're talking about this. How'd you do that? I don't know. It just came to me. And that's real. That is real. The supernatural is real. And I don't know why it's so hard for the modern mind, I guess, because it's a materialist mind, to accept that. But what you see, and that's not a new phenomenon. It's happened throughout history. There are people called prophets. And there are people who were prophets who weren't called prophets. But there are people who have information or parts of information, bits of information, visions of information come to them, and then they relay it. It's not from them. They received it. This is like the, you know, one of the oldest phenomena in human history. So those people tend to be a little crazy, a little imbalanced, a little different from everybody else. Do you know what I mean? They live on locusts and honey in the wilderness. I mean, that's just like they're not like everybody else. And that's clearly part of what – I'm not saying that everything that Alex Jones says is a prophecy from God. It's not. But that was prophetic. And if it wasn't, tell me how it wasn't. In July of 2000 – like I lived in Washington in July of 2001. You know, my dad worked in the government. Like I was as well informed as anybody could be about what was going on in the government. I've always been interested in what's happening in other countries. I was aware of Osama bin Laden. I knew about the Taliban. I knew, you know, more than most people. There's not one person – who was saying, not one person in Washington, D.C. was saying, you know, at some point soon, they may fly airplanes into the World Trade Centers and blame Osama bin Laden. Like, that just wasn't a thing. So if you said that multiple times on camera, there's a reason. Like, and everyone, I've said this to 50 people, what I just said to you, and they all look at me like, yeah, that's stupid. Tell me how it's stupid. Like, tell me how he did that. Like, that's impossible, actually.
He didn't just do it with that either.
No, I'm aware.
He's done it with a lot of things. And that's one of the more interesting things about him is that, like, he talks about stuff. Like, he talked about, like, I'm going to send this to Jamie, because this is one of the really crazy ones that he called. And this is like 2017. Here it is. Let me find this. Give me a second here. Because I sent it to him like, how the fuck did you call this? Because it's one of those ones where you're like, this is exactly what's happening now. Here it is. Here, 2017. Hold on a second. I'll send you this, Jamie. Come on. Technology, let's go. All right. I sent it to you, Jamie. So this is some guy's Instagram clip that I found that took a clip from the podcast, and he's doing commentary over. Put these things on real quick. You got it? Okay, cool. Here we go.
22 years on podcasts, InfoWars, Alex Jones, and Joe Rogan discuss what's currently happening right now. Google, CERN, technology, vampire, aliens. In a nutshell, Alex was pretty on point with this message. Let me know what your thoughts are. Is he crazy or is he on to something?
It's really big. So, okay. Yeah, pour another shot of that.
The media.
Get this out properly.
All right, let me give you my best, please. Deep research approximation.
What do you think is going on? But am I wrong to still hold out hope that aliens are real? Because I tell you, as one of the two guilty pleasures that I still cling to is Bigfoot and aliens. Those are two. Bigfoot, not so much. I wish it was real, but I just don't.
Are you ready?
Yes. Bigfoot's real?
No.
Come on, Daddy.
No. Are you ready?
Yes.
I'm going to give you the biggest shot of Joe. There are aliens in this room right now.
For real?
Yeah, you're not of this world, bro.
Me?
You're the alien.
Oh, wow, I didn't know.
Well, here's what the elite believe. And let me be very clear, because the media will take this out of context. I only go with what I can prove.
Oh, thank you.
And people can't even handle that. There's armies. We're fighting a pedophile conspiracy. But beyond that, it's a vampire conspiracy in that they are interdimensionally sucking the essence of our youth.
Right.
And they believe they're possessed by an off-world entity.
They do?
Yeah, and then, Joe, I've been on air 22 years. I don't get into aliens, metaphysical, religion, any of that. I've studied the elite, and I've also communicated with a lot of the top people. And if you want to know, I will actually break down right now the best knowledge right now what's happening on the planet.
What's happening?
The elite are all about transcendence and living forever and the secrets of the universe, and they want to know all this. Some are good, some are bad, some are a mix. But the good ones don't ever want to organize. The bad ones didn't want to organize because they lust after power. Powerful consciousnesses don't want to dominate other people. They want to empower them, so they don't tend to get together until things are really late in the game. Then they come together. Evil's always defeated because good is so much stronger. And we're on this planet, and Einstein's physics showed it, Max Planck's physics showed it, all. There's at least 12 dimensions. And now that's why all the top scientists and billionaires are coming out saying it's a false hologram. It is artificial. The computers are scanning it and finding tension points where it's artificially projected and gravity's bleeding in to this universe. That's what they call dark matter. So we're like a thought or a dream that's a wisp in some computer program, some God's mind, whatever. They're proving it all. It's all coming out. Now, there's like this sub-transmission zone below the third dimension. It's just turned over to the most horrible things is what it resonates to. And it's trying to get up into the third dimension. That's just a basic level consciousness to launch into the next levels. And our species is already way up in the fifth, sixth dimension, consciously our best people. But there's this big war trying to, like, basically destroy humanity because humanity has free will. And there's a decision to which level we want to go to. We have free will, so evil's allowed to come and contend, not just good. And the elites themselves believe they're racing using human technology to try to take our best minds and build some type of breakaway civilization where they're going to merge with machines, transcend, and break away from the failed species that is man, which is kind of like a false transmission because they're thinking what they are is ugly and bad, projecting it onto themselves instead of believing, no, it's a human test about building us up. And so Google was set up 18, 19 years ago, this was, I knew about this before it was declassified, I'm just saying I have good sources, that they wanted to build a giant artificial system, and Google believes that the first artificial intelligence will be a supercomputer based on the neuron activities of the hive mind of humanity, with billions of people wired into it with the Internet of Things. And so all of our thoughts go into it, and we're actually building a computer that has real neurons in real time that's also psychically connected to us, that are organic creatures, so that they will have current prediction powers, future prediction powers, a true crystal ball. But the big secret is, once you have a crystal ball and know the future, you can add stimuli beforehand and make decisions that control the future. And so then it's the end of consciousness and free will for individuals, as we know, and a true 2.0, in a very bad way, hive mind consciousness with an AI jacked into everyone, knowing our hopes and dreams, delivering it to us, not in some PKD wirehead system where we plug in and give up on consciousness because of unlimited pleasure, but because we were already wired in and absorbed before we knew it, by giving over our consciousness to the system by our daily decisions that it was able to manipulate and control into a larger system. There's now a human counterstrike taking place to shut this off before it gets fully into place, and to block these systems, and to try to have an actual debate about where humanity goes, and cut off the pedophiles and psychic vampires that are in control of this AI system before humanity's destroyed.
With AI? How'd they get, how'd the pedophile...
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's
I didn't understand about
it.
That was 7 years ago.
7 years ago.
Yeah, okay. So,
no, 7 years ago, no one was thinking AI was going to take over civilization.
So you can see why the FBI decided to destroy him, which it did. The people in, I mean, it's just like what has happened to Alex Jones is proof that at least some of what he's saying is true. Because why? Who is Alex Jones a threat to?
Did you see that interview with the guy from FBI trying to hook up with that dude on a date?
CIA, yeah.
Was it CIA?
CIA.
That's right. And they were talking about how they can destroy a person.
Yeah, I think I was mentioned in there too.
Were you? Yeah.
I was. Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things. Okay, so, yeah. Again, I don't know the third dimension. I don't know anything about dimensions. Okay, so I can't comment on that. But two things he said are true. One is that every civilization, every religion, the Greek myths, you know, every single one, including Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, has believed that there is sort of that the spirit world and humanity are like that. There's, you know, they're hybrids.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's just a fact. Genesis 6. So, you know, I don't think that's crazy at all, given that it has been the belief of civilizations that had no contact with each other.
I don't think it's crazy, and I also don't think it's crazy to consider it. I don't think we have a real map of reality.
Well, we definitely don't. And better put than I explained it. That's exactly right. We don't have a real map, and it's not crazy to consider it. And it was an entirely conventional view up until fairly recently, that the spirit world, like, I hate want to don't use the phrase, breeds with people, but that everyone thought that, okay?
Right. And even the term spirit world is probably a loaded term.
Yeah, of course, they're all
whatever
loaded terms.
It is.
How
right.
do you say it in a
right.
way that doesn't sound crazy? But the whole thing sounds crazy because we don't acknowledge the reality, the actual physical reality of the supernatural, and it is real. That's the first thing. The second point that's obviously true is that people, weak people, which is a synonym for bad people, come together for strength and safety. They act as one. Mm-hmm. The hive mind is specific to a certain group of people, bad people, and that good people don't tend to come together, but they're coming together now. And I just noticed this. I mean, people independently who I know or sort of know, in many cases have long despised, have come to exactly the same conclusions without talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you have this experience all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't believe you think that. How did you wind up thinking that?
Right.
And not just on a specific issue like foreign policy or COVID or whatever, but like on a whole bunch of different things. They're mm-hmm. all coming to the same conclusion, and they're coming together. And so that does suggest, you know, a big change and a battle. I mean, it is a battle between good and evil. I'm not always convinced I'm on the good side. I've been, you know, an instrument of evil many times in my life, and I'm ashamed of it. But
are you talking about the Iraq War?
Yeah, the Iraq War. I've been cruel to people, probably even already on your show in ways that are unjustified. That's my instinct to do that. That's a fault, not, you know, not something to brag about. It's something I'm ashamed of. So I'm not saying I'm always on the right side. I certainly have not always been on the right side. I've been on the wrong side many, many times. But that doesn't change the fact that there is good, there is evil. They are at war with each other, and we are subject to the effects of that conflict, and that we're seeing it suddenly play out in ways that are really, really obvious. There's no political explanation for the trans phenomenon. Nobody benefits. You can say, I hear see these right-wingers be like, really, it's all about the people who make synthetic hormones. They benefit. Yeah, okay, they benefit. But it's not driving it. That's stupid. It's not about the money, actually. There's no upside. It's not helping the kids at all. If a child has anorexia, which is pretty common, actually, in this country, and the child thinks she's fat, you don't say to the child, yeah, you're fat. You don't do that. You give the child help if you can. It's hard to treat, but you try. If a child comes to you and says, I think I was born in the wrong body, the last thing you do is affirm that. It's hurting the child. Like, why would you do that? If you love the child, you wouldn't do that. It's really an exercise undertaken for the sake of destruction, for the sake of hurting someone. There's no real upside. What's another phrase description of that? It's evil. And you see that a lot.
Yeah.
And why? Like, what is that?
What is it?
And why is it so obvious to a completely, even a completely secular person like me, all of a sudden? There's a reason for that. History is moving really, really fast. We're right in the middle of it. And I probably wouldn't have chosen to be born at the time I was. I'd much rather sort of reach maturity in 1955.
Really?
I don't know. I don't get to choose. You know, I don't like drama. I don't like change.
But there was drama and change back then, too.
There was, but people didn't recognize. Well, there was a Cold War, of course. There was a Korean War. Okay. But people didn't see it.
In their face.
Right. In the right way. I don't think.
Wouldn't you rather know?
I don't have a choice. I do know.
Yeah, I'd rather know. I'd rather be right now.
Yeah, well, got a much better attitude than I. I mean, sometimes my parents got divorced when I was little, and so I kind of like, I don't want change.
Yeah, you know? I know what you mean.
Like, it's not up to me.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I was having a conversation in the green room of the club the other night about this guy from Canada that's HIV positive, that's a trans woman, that's taking hormones so they can breastfeed their 9-month-old daughter. So a biological male is taking hormones and is now breastfeeding their daughter off of their male tit. And I said, if I was Satan, if Satan was real, I would do that.
Exactly.
If Satan's real, if Satan was going to do something insidious and unbelievably creepy, he would do that.
Well, I think he is doing that, obviously.
But this guy's a real freak.
Well, but right, and he's also
like using public money, too.
But he's a victim, too. I mean,
sure.
Because the thing about evil, the reason that evil is distinct from everything else, it destroys the vessel it's held in, the conduit through which it flows, destroys the person. So, that guy, in the end, will not thrive.
Right.
He'll be destroyed, too. And so that's how you know that it's supernatural. In other words, if I steal your iPhone and sell it and I get an extra $400, like, that's kind of explicable. You understand why I'm doing that. I want the $400.
Right.
But if I'm encouraging your kid to castrate himself, I'm not really benefiting from that, actually. There's no material benefit to me at all. There's no real psychic benefit. It's hurting for its own sake. And that's evil. There's no political category that explains that.
Right. And then there's clearly money involved in that.
There
too.
Is money, of
and then
course.
There's the gender affirming clinics that have popped up all over the country since 2007.
Sure.
You see the map of it. It's fucking bananas.
But why would you want to do that? That's why would policymakers want to do that?
Why would anybody want to make money that way? Right.
Well,
why
but
would
also
they choose
like,
to make
people,
money that way?
It's the most unnatural thing ever because parents. Every parent at a certain age feels is like, I like my kids. I want grandkids.
Right.
I want
and you want to protect your children.
Mine to continue. Yeah.
From bad decisions.
So I always think the politicians who push trannyism on the country, like, their kids are going trans too.
Yeah, they are.
Right. They're not escaping it. It's like they're burning down their own house.
I would like to see the statistics of people in Hollywood. Like, how many of their kids turn trans versus the rest of the world.
Of
I know some of them too.
Yeah.
But how many of them versus the rest of the world?
Well, a lot more. A lot more.
Which is a morally corrupt business.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, more than I knew. you know, the entertainment business.
It's always been that way. You know, Tarantino was talking to us about this famous old director that had a bedroom in his office where he would bed the starlets, and it was just common knowledge. If you wanted to be in his movie, you had to fuck him. And, no. And you'd go into his office, he had a literal bedroom in his office.
We had some of that in television, yes.
I'm sure.
Yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, and I didn't really understand. I didn't, you know, obviously partake in it, or you would know, because all my text messages went up in the New York Times. So I'm not hiding any of my own behavior. But, I mean, I will say, if I'm being honest, it didn't really register with me. I was like, yeah, that's kind of wild and crazy. I just didn't, you know, I like my wife. I don't want to blow up my family. I didn't do anything like that, really. But I certainly saw a lot, like a lot of it, like a lot. And I just didn't really see it as, like, horrifying. I just saw it as kind of like, well, you know, creative people are this way kind of thing. But I look back and I'm like, it was really dark. Bad.
Well, especially the producer thing, right? That, like, the Weinstein thing, that the way they ran the business, that's how it was pay to play.
I worked for Harvey Weinstein for a year.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did.
When?
1999. He had a magazine with Tina Brown called Talk Magazine. I was the head political writer for it. And they had an office at Carnegie Towers in New York, right below the park. And I remember the big I remember that he was a pig. I was not like an intimate friend of his or whatever, but I certainly dealt with him. And the big controversy was he was smoking in elevators. And I've kind of supported that, if I'm being honest. But he was considered incredibly insensitive and just like vulgar, just like a pig.
Well, he looks vulgar.
And yeah, well, that was certainly what everyone thought of him where I worked. Harvey's just a pig, and his brother Bob was a little bit less that way. He was also involved. But yeah, people knew that he was a bad guy, but like...
But he made awesome movies.
Yeah, and also, but he was just powerful. It's like, right. Harvey Weinstein. Like, right. You want to fuck with Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
I mean, I didn't really think about it too much, to be completely honest. He was just a guy I worked for. But I don't know. I didn't... I certainly, if you'd played that Alex Jones clip for me in 1999, I would have been... And I did see Alex Jones clips in 1999. And then in later years where he was talking about Building 7, and I was very offended. I was, like, outraged that he would be suggesting that there was something about 9/11 that wasn't above board, that there were, you know, things we didn't know that were being hidden from us. And I was, like, mad at Alex Jones for saying that. I remember that really well. How dare you?
The Building 7 one is wild.
Well, it is wild. It is wild. I mean, I have no idea. All I know is 21, I don't even know what year it is, 23 years? Could it really be 23 years after 9/11? 23 years. Later, what's the justification for classifying any document around 9/11? There's no justification.
Well, the same justification in classifying the documents about the Kennedy assassination.
Well, exactly, 61 years later.
Yeah, or releasing the COVID vaccine data 75 years later.
Of course.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's, of course, look, secrecy is different from privacy. Privacy is necessary for the dignity of this white. You've got a door in the bathroom in your bedroom, right? You know, you need privacy, you need private thoughts. We have no privacy whatsoever. None. No privacy at all. Thanks to the iPhone and government spying on us all. So there's no privacy, but there's massive secrecy. Secrecy is different. Secrecy abets lying. The only reason to have secrecy is in order to do something that you're ashamed of other people knowing about that's immoral and probably illegal. And there's more secrecy than ever. And that means that there's more lying than ever. There are more crimes being committed than ever. That's the surest sign of it. Why are there a billion classified federal documents in a so-called democracy? Because they're lying to us. That's why. But 9/11, like, what is the justification for that? I don't know the answer. I really don't know the answer. But there is one. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It's not methods and sources. You think it's methods and sources? Trying to protect their Saudi sources? I don't think so.
You know, the wildest thing about Tower 7 is that if you just say it looks like a controlled demolition, people get mad at you.
Why?
Well, I don't know.
Well,
because
I did.
I'm not saying that it is a controlled demolition. But I'm saying if you watch it, it looks like a controlled demolition.
But that happens all the time. Buildings catch fire and they just implode in on themselves. I think it happens every week, right? All these poultry plants and manufacturing plants that keep getting burned through fire, they all like...
It's the way it went down.
Yeah. So I say, why do they respond that way? And of course, I responded that way. So, and I think looking back, the reason that I did was because if you call that into question, you had to ask a lot of other really obvious questions you didn't want to deal with. And you might arrive at the conclusion that a lot of your most basic assumptions are false and that you've been had. And it's just too destabilizing, maybe.
Right. Well, the real problem with Tower 7 is they go, well, okay, if it was a controlled demolition, how was that engineered? Did they just decide to do that before September 11th? And you know how long it would take to rig a building like that?
Right.
Or was it built into the building? And how would they know it would even work? And how would they do something like that? And how would there not be a record of it being built into the building? Like, for someone to engineer
and where's
the collapse
sound signature
of a tower
on the tape? There would be a sound of the explosions going
on. Yeah, bang, bang,
which is a fair question.
Yeah, so a lot of fair questions. And has there ever been a building that experienced a tremendous amount of damage because two enormous skyscrapers fell right next to it, damaged it, and then massive fire started, and then there's diesel generators that are in the basement, so they have all this fuel, so they have this incredible inferno in the basement that weakens the structure. Mm-hmm. And is that why it collapsed? Maybe.
Totally possible. Yeah. A lot of building engineers disagree with that, as you know.
Yeah.
And they don't think that could have happened in the way you just described. I'm agnostic on it. What I know, because I don't know the answer, and I have no way of knowing. All I know is that there's no justification for keeping those documents secret that I can think of. And if there is, tell us what it is. No one has bothered because nobody presses. And it's, you know, I'll add that to the list of outrages.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And then it gives you this feeling of helplessness because there's so many of those. They just pile on. There's always another one.
Well, the U.S. government spied on me, broke into my phone and spied on me, and I couldn't get a straight answer to that. And I'm not a felon. And I'm
not only that, they got into your Signal account, right?
Yeah, and then they leaked it to the New York Times, what they found there. So it's one thing to say, okay, we picked up your text exchanges with a foreign national, which is true. I text a lot of foreign nationals because of my job. Like, why wouldn't I? And it's my right, as far as I'm concerned. That's not illegal. But we picked up your text exchanges, which I think itself is a lie. I think they were targeting me. I think they are now. I know I'm pretty positive they are. But whatever, leaving that aside. We spied on you. We think we have justification. Is there a justification for leaking the contents of my private conversation to a news outlet in order to discredit me? No, there's no. That's secret police shit, okay?
Yeah.
I'm not whining. Ooh, I'm a victim. I'm certainly not a victim. But what was infuriating was my total – and I got members of Congress involved because I was pissed and I felt threatened. I couldn't get a straight answer. They were just like, we're not answering those questions, and what are you going to do about it, bitch? What are you going to do about it? You know, I don't possess a drone fleet. There's nothing I can do about it, actually. That's the truth. So when the system breaks down and things like, I don't know, honesty, justice, the law, none of those apply, the people in charge decide, well, that doesn't apply to me, you are literally powerless. And
bizarre that the New York Times wouldn't have an issue with that.
Well, the New York Times does that all the time.
But bizarre that they wouldn't have an issue with the government tapping into your phone.
They work for the government. Are you kidding?
Right.
The New York Times? Yeah, the New York Times is a conduit for the lies of government. That's what it is. It's their tool, and they're perfectly aware of that. I mean, I used to write for the New York Times as a freelancer. I mean, I've been around the New York Times a lot, and there are a lot of really smart people there, but for sure, even now, I would less so now, but there's still, I think, smart people there. There are. I know some. And they know, but they think that, you know, it's worth it because they're bringing information, or I don't know what they think actually, but no, they're tools of power. And that's like the one thing that you're not allowed to be, even if you think the power is good. Like, maybe they all support the agenda of the U.S. government, destabilizing the world and impoverishing their own population. Maybe they're on board with that. Even if they are, they shouldn't do it, because the job of the media, the press, is to keep power in check. You are kind of like the seatbelt, right? You know,
right.
You make sure that things don't go too far. So, and they're not doing that. They're acting as a willing handmaiden.
When do you think that switched?
Well, I think it's been the case for a long time. I mean, if you look at what happened to Richard Nixon, which I, of course, did not understand at all, Richard Nixon was taken out by the FBI and CIA. And, with the help of Bob Woodward, who was a Washington Post reporter, who had been a naval intelligence officer working in the White House, working in the Nixon White House. And then he shows up like a year later, and he's this brand new reporter. He'd never been a journalist at all. He's a naval intel officer, the famous Bob Woodward we all revere. And he's at the Washington Post, and somehow he gets the biggest story in the history of the Washington Post. He's the lead guy in that story. well, I worked at a newspaper. I've been in the news business my whole life. That is not how it works. You don't take a kid like his first day from a totally unrelated business and put him on the biggest story. But he was. He was that guy. And who is his main source for Watergate? Oh, the number two guy at the FBI. Oh, so you have the Naval Intelligence Officer working with the FBI official to destroy the president. Okay, so that's a deep state coup. What else? How would you describe that? If that happened in Guatemala, what would you say? And yet the way it was framed and the way that I accepted for decades was, oh, this intrepid reporter fought power. No, no, no. This intrepid reporter, Bob Woodward, was a tool of power, secret power, which is the most threatening kind, to bounce the single most popular president in American history, Richard Nixon, from office before the end of his term and replace him with who? Oh, Gerald Ford, who sat on the Warren Commission. Now, how did Gerald Ford get to be Richard Nixon's vice president? Well, because Carl Albert, the Democrat Speaker of the House, told him, you must choose him. We will only confirm him when they sent the actual elected vice president away for tax evasion, Spiro Agnew of Maryland. So you have a complete setup, like an absolute. Gerald Ford, the only unelected president in American history, actually sat on the Warren Commission. Something else that I accepted at face value until I looked at it, and I was like, that's completely insane. You didn't want to interview Jack Ruby in your investigation of the assassination? Okay, you're fake. Yeah, he was on the Warren Commission. And so, sorry for the long story, but the point is, like that happened in front of all of us, but the way it was framed cloaked the obvious reality of it. The people who broke into the Watergate office building, from which the name is taken, Watergate, I think it was six of them or seven of them, all but one was a CIA employee. That's real. It's like, look it up on Google. So the whole thing, Richard Nixon was elected by more votes than any president in American history in the 1972 election. He was the most popular by votes, which is the only way we can really measure popularity, the most popular president in his reelection campaign. And 2 years later, he's gone. Undone by a naval intel officer, the number two guy at the FBI, and a bunch of CIA employees. You tell me what that is. Those are the facts. Those are not disputed facts. That's not crackpot shit. That's just look it up.
So why did they want to get rid of Nixon?
You know, there are a lot of theories on that. I mean, we don't need to know motive to know what happened. They, meaning unelected federal employees, got rid of Richard Nixon, which is the most anti-democratic way to make a leadership change that there is. Okay? I should just say at the outset, I actually kind of believe in democracy. Obviously, it's not working well. Obviously, it's ending globally. There will never be another liberal democracy, unfortunately. But I'm attached to it because I was born here. I really believe in it, and it's better than any other system. So that's why I'm pissed. What was their motive? There are a lot of theories on this. There's an amazing conversation. It's on tape between Richard Nixon when he was still president. I think it was in 1973. And I think it was Richard Helms, the head of the CIA, though I may have fucked that up. But it was the head of the CIA. And I think it was Helms. And Nixon says, I know why they killed Jack Kennedy. So Nixon was a student of history, obviously a flawed and complicated person, but a very, very smart person. And he was really interested in why this guy who'd been president, just one president before him, was murdered. And he didn't think it was a lone gunman who was mysteriously assassinated 2 days later by another lone gunman. Like, it's so obviously bullshit. And he knew that. And he said to the CIA director, who, and you can listen to the tape, it's on the internet, is totally silent on this question. So I think there was the impression, I don't think I know, that Nixon understood that the bureaucracy was really in control of the country. It wasn't elected officials. And that's a massive threat because it's true. So, and there may have been other reasons too that I'm not privy to. Look, I didn't even know any of this despite having moved to Washington in high school and been around this stuff a lot. I didn't know any of that. And I know Bob Woodward personally. So I didn't. And I know Carl Bernstein personally. I even worked for Carl Bernstein briefly. So I knew some of the actual players in this, but I didn't connect the obvious dots because they weren't framed that way. That's the point I'm making. It's the way that you frame things. You can have all the information available on Wikipedia, which is also controlled by the intel agencies, but there's still information on there. The information can be out there in the public domain. It's a matter of seeing it for what it is, right?
Yeah. So Nixon said that he knew why they killed JFK.
Mm-hmm.
Did he elaborate?
Nope. And it's worth listening to. It's a very weird conversation. It takes place in the Oval Office, which famously had tape recording devices in it. Obviously, this became a big feature during the Watergate hearings. But yes, that conversation, and I may be mangling it slightly, but it's on the internet and absolutely worth listening to. And the CIA director has this kind of sinister silence. So like if I'm the president and you're the CIA director and I say I know why the guy who was just president 10 years ago was killed, the obvious answer would be like, well, why?
Right.
I mean, what? You know why he was killed? You've got insight into the assassination of the U.S. president? He doesn't say anything. Just like a very weird response. Like, what? Just kind of throw that out there. Like, if you say to me, you know, we're taking a leak, you're at the next urinal, and you're like, I figured out the secret to life. And I'm like, huh, okay. That's like not a good response, right?
Right, right.
It's a telling response.
Did you hear Trump's take on the JFK assassination, why he didn't release the files?
Yeah, I know what Trump's take is.
He said that if you knew what I know, you wouldn't tell people either. Which is crazy.
Well, and that's his position on the UAP thing as well.
Yeah.
Actually. And that's a lot of people's position on it. I mean, you know, Trump is saying, of course, the CIA had knowledge of it. That is known. I mean, the whole thing. It's so funny. There's so many levels and there's so much I don't understand. But the whole JFK conspiracy industry, and it really is an industry, more books written on that than almost any historical topic, is filled with wackos, right? There mm-hmm. are a lot of wackos in
yeah.
there. But it obscures – that fact obscures the larger fact, which is the facts themselves tell an unbelievable story.
Yeah.
And so I could get into it at great length. But yeah – yeah, they're still classifying documents 61 years later. Both Trump and Joe Biden have, in violation of my read of federal law, kept those documents secret. There's no living person connected to the Kennedy assassination. It was a couple generations ago. There's no one person whose secrets are being protected. It's an institution, or maybe countries. There may have been countries involved, too. I mean, I don't know the answer, but there's clearly something worth protecting. And I know that when I spoke to someone who'd seen the documents, okay, 2 years ago, and I got one fact out of him, which is, yes, the CIA was involved. And by CIA is a huge organization, but James Jesus Angleton, the head of the operations directorate, had knowledge of this, which I think is well known. But that's the view of someone who saw the documents. So I thought that was news. So I went on TV and said that. The next day, I'll never forget it, I went quail hunting, and I was driving back, and I got a phone call from Mike Pompeo's lawyer. Mike Pompeo was the Secretary of State, but before then, he was the director of the CIA. And in that position, he plotted the murder of Julian Assange. So,
host of Truth Jihad Radio. Federal prosecutors, Department of Homeland Security agents, and curious passersby often ask me, just what is this Truth Jihad thing anyway? Well, everybody knows what truth is, but jihad is a misunderstood term. Jihad means effort or struggle. The greater jihad is the struggle to be a better person, while the lesser jihad is the struggle to defend the community. Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, did say that the best jihad is a word of truth flung in the face of a tyrant. And that's what we do here at Truth Jihad Radio. Every Friday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Pacific, right here on Revolution Radio.
Who owns you? If you're not in control,
than someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays for Voices on the Wind with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people on the fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at...